Wright versus Monwell, John C. Holler, and Justin L. Porter, Appellant Counsel, Susan Baumgartner, Assistant Attorney General, Appellant Counsel.
You may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, my name is Justin Porter, appearing today with John C. Holler on behalf of Appellant Mark O'Hara Wright on 5 assignments of error. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes to rebuttal. This case arose out of a shoplifting incident in Harrisonburg, Virginia, where Mark Wright, appellant, and his brother Robert shoplifted $50.45 worth of food and beverage from a grocery store, Martin's, in Harrisonburg. We are asking the court to invoke the ends of justice in our first assignment there to allow Mr. Wright to complain of the fact that he was convicted of a crime that he was not charged with or indicted for. And the indictment was for robbery related to our first assignment there. It was amended to principles, robbery as a principle in the second degree prior to trial. Proceeded through trial only after the close of all the evidence and the motions to strike did the Commonwealth purport to offer a jury instruction that included the lesser included offense of grand larceny from a person. This court has held that grand larceny from a person is not a lesser included offense. We recognize that the court does not go out of its way to invoke the ends of justice exception in cases where the Commonwealth simply fails to prove one element of an offense, for example. But I would point to the court to its decisions in Jimenez v. Commonwealth and Ball v. Commonwealth, where this court has recognized and has invoked the ends of justice exception, where the Commonwealth fails to prove a required element of offense and the jury is improperly or incorrectly instructed regarding that offense. We submit that that's what happened in this case.
Counsel, may I ask you a question?
Please.
What was the Court of Appeals holding on this issue?
The Court of Appeals denied our petition related to this first assignment of error.
Why? What was the ground? I know they denied it, but what were the grounds of denial?
That it had not, Mark Wright's trial counsel had not objected to that instruction, and so that argument had not been made before the trial court, and the appeal was the improper time.
So it was a 5A18 dismissal?
Correct. But we submit that Mark Wright was convicted of a crime he wasn't charged with. The Commonwealth failed to prove a required element of that charge, the grand larceny of a person, and that's the value of the item taken from the Martin's employee. And the jury, perhaps most significantly, the jury was not even given the option, according to the record, of finding Mark Wright not guilty of either robbery or grand larceny on a person. The jury instruction only gives them the option of finding them guilty of robbery or guilty of grand larceny from a person. For those reasons, we're asking the court to invoke the ends of justice exception.
Mr. Carter, can I ask you one question? Did they also reject the ends of justice argument that you made?
Yes, there was a demand for a 3-judge panel, and we asked the court to invoke ends of justice to allow us to make the argument and they denied the petition related to that assignment of error. We recognize that ordinarily a trial court is under no obligation to correct misstatements of law, but this court, I would point the court to its decision in Atkins v. Commonwealth, where it held that where a principle of law is materially vital to a defendant, the trial court, it's reversible error for a trial court to improperly instruct a jury. And in Atkins,
Let me ask you a question about that. Are you talking about Instruction 10, which is the one about the crime of robbery?
Yes, sir.
Well, that does certainly give the jury the opportunity to find him not guilty.
And the instruction I'm referring to, of course, is the verdict form.
The verdict form. That's different than the instruction. And the verdict form is far from clear because there's certainly a colloquy between the judge and counsel about that. I think if you look on page 194, they talk about that, and they say, we're missing, the judge even says, we're missing the not guilty part of it. And they say, yes, here it is. And it says, or is on the top of the next page, and that can go ahead and staple together.
And I believe that discussion is in reference to the malicious wounding charge. the court actually attaches the fact that there was no option to find him not guilty of either malicious wounding or unlawful wounding, and so they have that discussion at that point.
But you don't think it happened with this one?
And there was no discussion in the record related to the grand larceny or robbery charge. I would point out that the verdict form for the malicious wounding or unlawful wounding likewise does not. There appears to be nowhere in the record where they're given the opportunity to find him not guilty of either of those charges. So we submit that it's materially vital that they be given a proper verdict form.
But you didn't raise that objection until recently.
We've challenged that conviction under other grounds.
Right. Okay.
I would note briefly, the Commonwealth argued in its brief that Mark Wright's trial counsel approbated and reprobated a trial in that he made the trial strategy decision to ask the jury to convict him of grand larceny from a person as opposed to convicting him of robbery. We would submit that's simply not in the record. Mark Wright's counsel asked the jury to find him guilty of petty larceny and quoted from that indictment. It's on appendix page 4B or 24th round. He submitted the whole time he stole subs and beer from Martin's, find him guilty of that charge, but not robbery.
There's actually two separate indictments, one for a larceny from Martin's, a petty larceny or shoplifting,
petty larceny.
And then a robbery from the store
That's correct. There's a robbery indictment and a petty larceny indictment. And that charge is not before this.
Do you think a fair reading of his closing argument was, let's find him guilty of the petty larceny, but he always said he's not guilty of the robbery?
Exactly. And he tracks the language of that indictment on 4D when he makes that argument. Regarding our second assignment error, I would rely briefly, primarily upon our brief in that matter. I would just submit that given the purposes outlined by this court in Finley v. Commonwealth, the purposes for assignments of error, we'd submit that the Commonwealth had sufficient notice, sufficient opportunity to prepare an effective brief in opposition to our argument related to the value of the item. But I would rely on our brief primarily.
Well, Mr. Cordero, on that point, what was the trial, the Court of Appeals ruling on that?
The Court of
Appeals
ruling was that the assignment of error regarding sufficiency of the evidence as to the grand larceny from the person charged did not cover the value, our argument that the Commonwealth did not prove the value of the item.
So the Court of Appeals did not make a ruling on the
value. They did not address our argument.
Did not address.
Right. That was not covered by that assignment of error. And if I can turn to our last three assignments of error, these are straight sufficiency arguments related to there was an assault of Deputy Christopher Greathead, a Rockingham County Sheriff's deputy. About an hour after the shoplifting, he responded to a home, investigating whether or not a vehicle that might have been involved in the shoplifting was at the home. The Commonwealth and the Court of Appeals the Court of Appeals held that the evidence was sufficient to convict of the charges related to the assault of Deputy Greathead in the basement of that home because the jury could have inferred that Mark Wright might have been present when the assault occurred. We submit there's simply no evidence that he was present at or participated in or in any way encouraged or incited that assault. There is the shoplifting occurred at 6 p.m. at Martin's in the city of Harrisonburg. Mark Wright, there's no evidence as to his location at any point in the home until 10 p.m., 4 hours later, when police ultimately enter the home and arrest he and Robert Wright. But in those intervening 4 hours, there's no evidence as to Mark Wright's location or activities inside the home apart from a phone call. But we have no idea of what time the phone call was made or anything like that. We have an assault. The assault occurred around 7 p.m. in the basement, and Deputy Greathead was given every opportunity to implicate Mark Wright. But to his credit, I would submit he consistently testified he only saw, only heard, only interacted with Robert Wright. And that when he went into the basement because there was a chlorine smell and they were worried about some gas, he rounded several corners, went down a long hallway into a small room where he encountered Robert Wright, initially about 12 feet from him. Despite his commands to the contrary, Robert Wright approached Deputy Greathead. There was a water heater about 2 feet. Deputy Greathead says a couple feet in front of him. Robert Wright approaches the water heater, has his hands up. The Court of Appeals, I know, found that the jury could have inferred that Mark Wright assaulted the officer while Robert Wright's hands were raised. The testimony, however, from Deputy Greathead was He was only sprayed with this bear repellent after Robert Wright approached the water heater, put his beer on top of the water heater, dropped his left arm behind the water heater where it was obscured from Deputy Graypen's vision, and a second or two after he dropped his arm behind the water heater, that's when Deputy Graypen noticed an orange cloud coming towards him from right beside Robert Wright, right in that area where his arm was obscured. So there's no evidence that, the deputy was assaulted while Robert Wright's hands were up. The deputy, we think, significantly testified that he conducted no sweep of the house, either the basement or the first floor, prior to being assaulted. He couldn't say, quite honestly, he said, I couldn't say where Mark Wright was at any point. The only time he encountered Mark Wright at any point that evening was 3 hours after the assault, when police ultimately entered the residence. And again, I would point out that this assault occurred between 2 and 6 feet from the person of Deputy Greathead, who was shining his patrol light in the direction of Robert Wright. This was a face-to-face encounter, essentially. The Commonwealth makes the argument that, well, Mark Wright must have been present because he had to be decontaminated after his arrest. But Deputy Greathead, I point the court to I believe it's appendix page 84, Deputy Greathead testified that anyone who entered the house that night had to be decontaminated because there were particulates in the air. It was in your skin, on your skin, it got on your clothing. So everybody who went in the house had to be decontaminated. We would just submit that there's a complete lack of evidence as to Mark Wright's participation, presence at, or that he in any way encouraged this assault. I would briefly address that the Commonwealth argues that while there may be sufficient evidence that Mark Wright committed these assaults as a principal in the second degree, however, this court consistently recognizes that presence alone is not sufficient to convict, and we would submit that here we don't even have presence. That has not been proven. It's simply not in the record of the trial in this case. And if I may, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
3 minutes and 18 seconds.
Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. May it please the court. Starting with the issues about grand larceny from the person. While grand larceny from the person is not a lesser included offense to robbery, that was waived when the defendant failed to object to the instruction. All indications in the record that this instruction was not somehow sprung upon the defense, but rather the Commonwealth said in court on 169 of the record that they were in agreement to the robbery instruction but for the fifth element of robbery. Now, Wright's attorney never said, we're in agreement except for the fifth element of robbery and treating grand larceny from the person as a lesser included offense. He didn't object at that point. Instead, he reiterated that his objection was to the phrasing of robbery's fifth element. And he also did not object to sentencing. It was simply never an issue until it was before the Court of Appeals. That's too late to preserve the issue. At that point, the jury instructions are the law of the case. Furthermore, I don't think it's so clear from the record that the defendant was just arguing in closing to the jury, convict me of the petty larceny, not robbery. Because, in fact, what he says is, there's larceny. I concede that my client committed larceny. That's what you should convict him of, not the robbery. He never specifies that he means just the petty larceny. And because the grand larceny from the person and the robbery were charged in the alternative, it would have been reasonable for the jury to infer that that's what he was asking. Ignore the robbery. Convict me of the alternative of the grand larceny from the person.
Counsel, is that a fair recitation of what his argument was? Because if you look at the bottom of page 18, it's a quote from his closing argument, and he's talking about the larceny from Martins of the Subs. He's not talking, that's the one he says, find me guilty of. Yes, he took the Subs and the beer from Martins. Yeah, find him guilty of that. But then he says he's not guilty of anything connected with the robbery. I don't think he approbated and reprobated like we found in Roe, did he?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because what he says is he did steal beer and subs from Martins. And the beer that's taken back...
But those are two separate indictments, aren't they? There's an indictment for larceny from Martins, and there's also a separate indictment for the robbery.
Correct, but the robbery is the beer from the Martins employee who tries to take it back. So the beer from Martin's is...
That's the second case of beer. There are two cases of beer.
Correct.
So as Justice Millett is saying, why couldn't he just as easily have been saying, I took the beer that I had and the sub, so I'm guilty of the larceny.
Well,
as opposed to even addressing the case that the Martin employee has possession of.
Because the only thing he's arguing there about why he didn't commit the robbery is the fifth element. And those are charged in the alternative, and that's the distinction between the grand larceny from the person and the robbery and what the jury was charged, that fifth element of the threat, the intimidation. And he's saying there's no threat, there's no intimidation. Yeah, he stole the beer from Martin's. What's in the Martin's parking lot if he takes the beer back, or rather that his brother, he's charged as a principal in the second degree, takes the beer back from the Martin's employee? So I do think that's easily confusing to the jury. He quite likely did get...
It's certainly not the level of approbation or reprobation we found in Roe, is it?
No.
Not anywhere near it.
I wouldn't say it's quite that level. However, when you combine that with the fact that there was no objection whatsoever to charging them in the alternative.
I understand that argument.
Well, now, counsel, admittedly there was no objection, but why wouldn't this be a case that we should consider under the ends of justice?
Because there's no evidence that explicitly negates any of the elements of grand larceny from the person. Under Jimenez, it's not sufficient to simply prove that perhaps an element wasn't proven sufficiently, but an element must be affirmatively disproved, and none of the elements of grand larceny from the person were affirmatively disproved in this case, because, in fact, the beer was taken back from the Martin employee's hands, and there was sufficient evidence of value. Certainly, there was no evidence the value was less than $5. Before I get to the value issue, I would like to briefly address the verdict form issue. The jury was clearly instructed that they could not convict unless all the elements were beyond a reasonable doubt on each of the charges. The jury verdict form issue is not encompassed by the assignment of error. It was simply not properly raised as part of the assignment of error. And it also was not raised at trial by Mr. Wright's attorney. Instead, the Commonwealth pointed out at pages 199 and 200 of the record, it looks like we're missing a page here about giving them the option of charging not guilty. And whether that's about the malicious wounding or about the robbery, it looks like they fixed it. They stapled some pages together. That's talked about in the record. Had it properly been raised as an assignment of error, perhaps the Commonwealth could have filed some sort of writ to find out what happened to that second page that does not actually appear in the record, or file a statement of facts. But instead, it was not properly raised before this court. It is not part of the assignment of error. It's a different error. Also, the issue of value, the $5. Was this 12-pack of Dos Equis worth $5 or not? This was also raised the first time on appeal.
Can we take judicial notice of that?
If Kelsey were here, I'd say definitely yes.
Did it include...
Judicial notice case, not because of the beer issue.
Did it include lime?
I'm sorry?
Did it include limes?
I don't think it did. I think it was just sandwiches and beer. But based on the value of the sandwiches that there are pictures of in the record, and the fact that there was about $34 after the values of the sandwiches, and there were 2 12 packs of beer, one of them being Ice House in cans and one being Dos Equis in bottles, I do think it was reasonable for the jury, even if this had been preserved and had been encompassed by the assignment of error, I think it was reasonable for the jury to figure it just that 12-pack met the de minimis amount.
Well, counsel, which assignment of error are you talking about?
In the Court of Appeals.
The one in the Court of Appeals, not
correct.
This court.
Correct. The
All right.
Court of Appeals assignment of error was that the grand larceny from the person was not sufficiently proven because there wasn't sufficient evidence that Mark Wright was participating in his brother Robert Wright's grand larceny from the person, whereas here the value is raised as an assignment of error. Moving on to the sufficiency, the three remaining assignments of error, I think they all rise and fall together. There is evidence in the record. This Commonwealth is entitled to all reasonable inferences, and this was, in part, a circumstantial case. The defendant's argument really kind of requires this court to credit Mark Wright, or rather Robert Wright's testimony and not so much Deputy Greathead's, because there is sufficient evidence from Deputy Greathead, from other police officers, that the defendant is in the basement the whole time. There is no question he is in the basement when the police get there. They lock down the house. The aunt and mother are talking about how they are downstairs. They were afraid they are going to kill themselves. That's the two brothers, the Wright brothers, Mark and Robert. And then at the end, they're both down there. Simply, with the evidence in the record that the house is locked down, there's no way he could get into the basement after the police arrive and be there at 10 o'clock.
Can I ask you a question? Because my understanding, when they talk about the basement, the officer talked about going around a number of corners. So it sounds like the basement is compartmentalized in some form or fashion.
Yes, I believe there are multiple rooms in the basement.
Okay, so you just know he was down there somewhere.
Well, there's also sufficient evidence that he was in the room with the water heater. And that's because I don't think it's so clear that somehow Deputy Greathead is suggesting that Robert could have released it. When he talks about it in the record, he talks about how Robert, he walks into the water heater room. It's a small room. He's heard Robert yell at him. And he tells him to come out. This is on page 72 and 73 of the record. What did he have in his hands? I told him to show me his hands. He raised them up. He had a beer bottle in his left hand, and the other hand was empty. What happened after he advised him to raise his hands? I put the bottle down, basically giving him commands to surrender to me. Instead, he approached me. A couple feet in front of me, there was a water heater. He approached that, maybe 6 feet from it. I was still giving him commands to get back, get down. He set the beer bottle on the water heater. The officer testified that he had his patrol light on. He has it trained on Robert Wright in an otherwise dark room. After he set his beer bottle on the water heater, what happened next? I told him to back up and still raise his hand. At that point, I saw a reddish-orange cloud come my direction from the back of the water heater. And he does say that that cloud was originating next to Robert, but he doesn't say anything about his hand disappearing behind or where this bear repellent would have come from. And it's not at all clear that it was clearly Robert doing it. Rather, the officer is facing Robert. He's looking at Robert, and he doesn't see him release the bear repellent. The jury was perfectly able to assume from this, from the photographs of the scene, by the way the lighting was, by the size of the water heater, that the person hiding behind there was, in fact, Mark Wright.
Whoa. There's no evidence that there was a person hiding behind there.
There is evidence that...
The only evidence is that Mark Wright was in the basement.
Yes, but there's also evidence from which the jury could infer that Robert Wright would not have been able to release the bear repellent without Deputy Greathead noticing. Because he doesn't have it in his hands, and he's watching him, and he doesn't say anything like, I lost track of his hands long enough that he could have pulled... he could have released the bear repellent. What we do have is the circumstantial evidence that Mark Wright was in that room. And
we have circumstantial evidence that he was in that level.
We also have circumstantial evidence that he was in that room.
Which is?
First of all, that he had to be decontaminated. And if we're in a multi-compartmentalized area...
Where is the expert testimony that one needed to be in that room in order to be decontaminated, as opposed to being in the room immediately adjacent to it where the cloud wafted into?
I don't think there is expert... There is no expert testimony.
So we don't know. We have no evidence at all about whether one has to be in that room in order to be decontaminated.
Well, certainly there's no evidence that the ants who were upstairs... when there was the first smell, had to be decontaminated.
But they weren't convicted of a crime, so we're not dealing with... Anyway, go ahead.
I'm sorry. It seems like temporally that's something separate, because at the point that Officer went downstairs with his flashlight and his gun, the aunts were not in the house anymore, right?
Correct, but there had already been a smell, because they'd already complained.
Right, but we don't know that it was the bear repellent as opposed to the... I forgot what the other stuff was.
Correct.
That had been sprayed.
The other circumstantial evidence is there are two beer bottles. Or rather, there was a beer bottle and a beer can. sitting on that water heater. One of them is Robert Wright's admitted bottle of Dos Equis. If you look in the photos, I have the page in the brief. Next to it is one of the Ice House tall boys that was also stolen from Martin's. I think the jury could infer from that that Mark Wright and Robert Wright were together in the water heater room, and that's why both of them have beer, empty beer cans left in the water heater room. The other option is that the jury found him guilty as a principal in the second degree. That is all that needs to be found. And there's certainly evidence that they planned their shoplifting together. They were acting in concert during the grand larceny from the person. They went home together to their aunt's house. They hid in the basement together. They fought the police together when the police got in there. And there's certainly sufficient evidence that they had the time to plan how they were going to react.
Can I stop you for a second? You said they both fought the police together down in the basement?
When they were not cooperative when the police actually came to arrest them. And there's certainly enough evidence there that it cannot be said that the jury was plainly wrong. And that's the standard here, that there has to be at least some evidence to support the jury's verdict that Mark Wright was participating in it. If there are no further questions, I urge you to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly, regarding the jury instruction, the Commonwealth argues that it became the law of the case when it was given. However, while there's ordinarily no obligation to correct a misstatement of the law, this Court has recognized that where principal law is materially vital to a defendant, it's reversible error to not correct it. And in Atkins, the giving a proper verdict form was materially vital, so we submit that that's where the error is in not giving a proper verdict form. Regarding the approbation and reprobation, Mark Wright's trial counsel was talking about that he stole subs and beer from Martin's, which was a separate charge from the robbery of the person related in the parking lot. I think it's clear he never once mentioned anywhere in closing argument, in any motion to strike, grand larceny from the person. Regarding the value, the $5, a question of judicial notice, but there was no evidence as to how many sandwiches were stolen from Martin's. There's evidence that at least two cases of beer were stolen and then several sandwiches. But there is no evidence anywhere that only two sandwiches or three sandwiches were stolen, that it's just beer and sandwiches. So to subtract from the total amount, they could have put in a receipt for here's the items, here's what they're worth. That wasn't put into evidence. We can't assume, there's no evidence to say here there were some wrappers with price, but there's no evidence that those were the only sandwiches. There's just wrappers that were submitted as pictures. But there was no testimony that this is all that we found, or we searched the van and there was no sandwiches or beer in the van. That just didn't come into evidence.
Mr. Corday, this may be a rather technical question, but with regard to the issue of your first assignment of error and the one regarding the value, it appears that the Court of Appeals didn't rule on either one of those. They just precluded them under statutory, under the rules, and refused the ends of justice on the first one. Normally, you're required to assign error to the ruling of the Court of Appeals. And your assignments of error don't seem to do that.
Our first assignment of error was just denied by the Court of Appeals. And so we assign error to their, our first assignment is to their refusal. But the argument we make regarding the verdict form, Commonwealth says, well, that's not covered by the assignment of error. It's a factor to be considered when asking the court to invoke ends of justice.
Well, that's not my point. The Court of Appeals denied your petition on the first assignment of error and denied your request. They denied your first assignment of error because they said it was waived, a 5A18, which you agreed, and then they refused to consider the ends of justice. That was their ruling, wasn't it?
That's correct.
Okay. And my question is that normally we have to appeal the ruling of the Court of Appeals on a given issue.
And we submit that our first assignment of error in this court is addresses the Court of Appeals error in ruling against us on the first assignment of error. I would point the court, the house had multiple floors, by the way, at least two floors, multiple bedrooms, kitchens, hallways, living rooms. There's no evidence that Mark Wright was in the basement at any particular point. There's no evidence that they secured the first floor, and no one was in the first floor for those four floors. There was evidence they were outside. I would just
Your time has expired.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All rise.